On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Wisconsin's top education official and a bit of a roadmap for where we intend to go. The U.S. Department of Education approving all but a slice of Wisconsin's overall plan for pandemic relief funds. We'll talk about that. The spread of COVID in schools and how districts are responding. And we start with the movement away from standardized testing and what it signifies. Should the UW system carry on with not requiring the ACT or SAT for admission? Parents, how is your child doing in these times? What do you want to convey? 800-642-1234. Jill Underle is State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Superintendent Underle, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. So starting with college entrance exams, ACTs, SATs, UW system extends the test optional policy through 2025 school year. We heard from Speaker Robin Voss Friday, who said extending the policy just worsens poor performance, leaves high school students ill-equipped for college. How do you feel about the policy extension?
You know, I'm mixed on the policy extension. I see it on one hand that when you take the ACT, it's a measure, just a one-time, you know, point-in-time measure. It's also in our state statutes that we have to have a assessment at 11th grade. And so since we had low participation rates on the ACT, it made sense to require the ACT for our 11th graders. So, I mean, I see both sides of it. But on the other hand, I know the UW system is investigating it. It seems that nationally, lots of very competitive schools are also breaking away from this as an entrance requirement. I think how it ends up, it remains to be known. Mm-hmm. I know that the system is studying it. So, I do feel mixed about it because we use that information in different ways, so like scholarships, for example. It might put more emphasis on GPAs instead. So, yeah, there's a lot to learn. But, again, we're in a pandemic and conditions are not conducive, you know, for students to be, you know, measured equally, I suppose, with an ACT.
Are you reconsidering that position, DPI still requiring 11th graders to take the ACT, given what the UW system is doing?
We are talking about it. Part of it is, again, it's state statute. It's mm-hmm. not a DPI thing. State statute requires an assessment statewide in all our schools for 9th, 10th, and 11th grade. And so that's why it made sense to require something in 11th grade, the ACT, because it can't be, again, something that is the smarter balanced assessment, which we require in 9th and 10th grade. So, yeah, if we do move away from the ACT, we'd have to come up with a different assessment.
Looking now at COVID, DHS active COVID investigations by facility type, it's educational facilities that account for nearly half of all current facility investigations, almost 1,400. How are your districts doing with managing outbreaks?
I think the districts are doing the best that they possibly can. You know, I was a school district superintendent the earlier part of this year in Iowa, Lafayette counties, and it's day to day. You know, we're trying to make sure that we have mitigation measures in place, you know, masking, for example, you know, just making sure that people who have symptoms stay home. You know, I can tell you that it's more stressful this year on our school administrators than it was last year because we know more about COVID. We know more how it's spread than what we did at the start of the pandemic or even start of the last school year. So we're able to adjust. But, you know, we have a lot of challenges. And so we have to approach it like we would any other infectious disease.
The 5 to 11-year-old COVID vaccine age group rollout well underway, as you know. And some schools have been holding vaccine clinics. How did this mode of vaccine delivery work? What's been uptake like when vaccines are given in schools?
When vaccines are given, I mean, again, it's a strong mitigation measure. We know that the vaccines work. And I kind of look at it from, you know, a very high level view. What's the goal here, right? We want our schools to be open, right? We don't want our schools to close. If we want our schools to be open, we need to do the things that we know work. And we're so grateful for science and the fact that we are able to have a vaccine for the youngest kids because that was the most concerning part earlier in the school year and much of the end of last school year was, you know, we can't fully open our schools and kids and staff can't fully be safe unless the youngest kids are protected.
We have Jill Enderle with us, State Superintendent of Public Instruction. You can join in. Are you a parent? What questions do you have for the State Superintendent? How has your child done in school this year? What about learning loss? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's move now to pandemic relief aid for schools through ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act. We saw the co-chairs of Joint Finance Committee said to you in a letter Thursday to immediately propose an alternative to the state's education pandemic relief plan after part of it was rejected by the Department of Education. You shot back Friday in a letter to JFC that lawmakers had engaged in a game of high-stakes chicken. Can you explain this disagreement that's going on?
Yeah, so we're talking about 5%. So 95% of the plan was approved. And back in May, so this is before I took office. I took office in July. So back in May, Joint Finance Committee had a motion 57, which took our 10% set aside, which all states were required to take. So it's about 100, maybe around 150 million-ish. And 5%, so that money was supposed to go to the kids that lost the most during the pandemic. So when you think back to that first year of, you know, the 2021 school year, the first full year of the pandemic in our schools, the kids that lost the most, right, what comes to mind? You know, it's the kids who don't have the enrichment, the kids who don't have the after-school programs or the preschool and the childcare and the full-day 4K and all these things. Perhaps it's the individual literacy tutoring or the math tutoring. There's a lot of things, mental health, technology, all these things. Well, in May, Motion 57, our joint finance chairs wanted to reward, and that was the word they used in their letter, reward schools for staying open. And we know that a lot of
for in-class instruction.
In-class instruction, thank you. Reward them for being open for in-class instruction in person. And we know that a lot of schools couldn't. You know, they have outdated facilities. They were overcrowded. I mean, there's a lot of things. And so anyway, DPI at the time warned the co-chairs and said, look, this isn't going to pass muster. It doesn't meet the law. And they, you know, said submit it anyway. So we did. And we've been in communication, you know, this is a lot of money. The U.S. Department of Ed is really looking at these plans. They asked some questions over the summer. We kept the co-chairs apprised of everything. And so it came back Monday of last week saying, look, everything looks good except for this 5%. You can't reward schools for being open for in-person instruction. It doesn't meet the intent of what the U.S. Congress said needed to be done. So we had to, you know, they said, fix it. And so we shared that information with the Joint Finance, and they shot back with this letter saying that I was colluding, or DPI was colluding with Congress on this, or with the U.S. Department of Ed, sorry. And that was what was so shocking to me, was because, like, we knew this was going to happen. We kind of prepared them for it. We've been in communication with them. And for them to you know, make the claim that we weren't working with them and that I was, you know, somehow obstructing, or, you know, it was really, it was just offensive and it was very political. And so, yeah, I shot back. I was like, look, if you know, rewarding schools is not what we do, right? The Department of Public Instruction is, you know, we get this money from the federal government. We have to follow the rules of the federal government. I, as a state constitutional officer, I have to uphold the Constitution of the United States. I'm going to follow what Congress says.
I just want to pause here for just a moment, because you told JFC there is middle ground here. What would you suggest as a compromise?
Yeah, sorry to go off on that, but you're right. There is middle ground. We can certainly find middle ground. They're going to have to budge, though. They're going to have to get away from the notion that we're using this money to reward schools that were open for in-person instruction. Rather, we have to identify the areas that, you know, are in the most need. Maybe we can use that $77 million for after-school programming, for tutoring, for learning loss. That's what we need to do.
Jill Enderle, superintendent of DPI, Department of Public Instruction, took office in July. Is your school facing a shortage of substitute teachers? What about bus drivers? How is that affecting education? What should the state do better to support teachers and students? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learned in October public school enrollment did not rebound this fall after last year's big pandemic-related drop in numbers. And last month, the State Education Department released test scores, how students are performing statewide. Is your family coping with learning loss? How was your school helping your child catch up to grade level? Are mental health needs being met? 800-642-1234. Superintendent of Public Instruction Jill Enderle stays with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's take a call now. John is joining us in Appleton. Hi, John. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Thanks, both of you, for your great service. I wanted to offer the idea of a year-round calendar where students are in session six to nine weeks at a time, and then they get 2 to 3 weeks off as a way to address learning loss. I'm a former educator, counselor, and school board member, and think that the school should look at this, especially with learning loss. There's a nice plan outlined on the NAYRE website, NAYRE.org, that I would cite as an example.
John,
what do you think about that?
John, thank you. Superintendent Enderle.
Thank you so much for that question, John. No, I agree with you on that. I think it would certainly be beneficial for, like you said, learning loss. Kids are learning all year. You know, we have more frequent, shorter breaks, I guess, rather than like the 3-month break that we traditionally have over summer. You know, it also, I think, would help with mental health. I think, you know, when you look at burnout and you look not just at our kids, but also our adults that are working in schools, I think that calendar, a more balanced calendar, what they call it in other states, is beneficial. The issue we have in Wisconsin is that we have a state statute that says that we can't start school until September 1st. And so we'd have to kind of get around, you know, we'd have to somehow change that law. You know, and that would be, you know, something I would be in favor of.
John, thank you for that. Let's go to Jennifer now. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Just looking at how state report cards just came out and knowing past history, Wisconsin reading scores have been continuing to go down. And due to COVID, now would be a more than perfect time to kind of address some of that loss in the area of reading. And looking at scientifically how reading happens in the brain, and using some of those resources across the state of Wisconsin and implementing that, how does Superintendent Enderle plan to address that the issue of reading in our state?
Yeah, I agree with you. I looking at the CLEP scores, they're certainly concerning when you look at the number of kids who are proficient in reading versus, you know, what they consider basic or even advanced. I mean, we got to get that big group of kids there in the middle moving ahead. I think you're right. I mean, we certainly know what works when it comes down to the different methods and the science of reading. It's making sure that we have a statewide plan to address it. And so that's what we're doing at DPI, is creating the statewide plan with stakeholders from the legislature, as well as the professional reading organizations and reading professors and teachers. And so once we have that in place, we can really work with our school districts to make sure our teachers know the way to roll things out through professional development and looking at the different interventions that work with our kids. It's just, in our state, we are very much a local control state. There's a patchwork of different programs throughout the state. Some, you know, school districts use a certain type of method and of instruction. Others use other things, and so having some consistency around, materials, for example, and making sure that our teachers are trained in the best instructional practices will help.
We've had conversations about teaching phonics and the role mm-hmm. of phonics. Where does that fall as you look at districts around the state and the use of phonics?
Yeah, and in phonics, I'm just going to speak from the experiences of the districts that I know the best. It's one of the tools, right? Mm. When you think about how instruction of reading takes place, you have like your curriculum that's about 80% of the kids are going to understand it. And then, phonics is part of that. But some kids need more intensive help in phonics. They need more intensive instruction. And I'll be honest, I was one of those kids. And so making sure that we have our teachers trained to provide that intensive intervention is important. And, our schools do have that, but we don't have a good measurement as to what extent or how in-depth they go.
Jennifer, thank you for that call. I want to turn to substitute teachers because we've been watching reports and asking questions about a possible substitute teacher shortage in Wisconsin, that demand for subs in some districts outstrips the available teachers to step in. What are you finding in this area?
Yes, we have seen substitute shortages, not just with teachers, but with in other parts of our building, like food service or custodial or bus drivers. And so, Wisconsin is no different. We're seeing it across the nation. And, when you think about prior to the pandemic, we had a shortage. And the pandemic just made it worse. And partly because substitute teachers tend to be former teachers. A lot of them are former teachers who recently retired. And many of those initially, in the beginning stages of COVID, were part of that most vulnerable group. So they didn't sub. And then it's compounded. We have made some changes to our licensing requirements when it comes to substitutes. So, for example, you need a 2-year associate's degree now, and you can get a substitute teaching license. Before, you had to have a 4-year degree. Now, you can get those who have 4-year degrees can get a 1-year license, which allows them to substitute teach for an entire year. So we encourage school districts to build and grow relationships with colleges and universities in our communities, but we have to look at pay too. The pay for substitute teachers varies from district to district. In a lot of the districts in my area, it's between $100 and $120 a day. Hmm. Do the math. It's not, you can find more pay, I think, in other sectors.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jill Underle, who is the head of the State Department of Public Instruction. You can join in with your questions about education around the state. Are you a teacher at a school that's seeing a shortage of substitute teachers, bus drivers, of other areas in the school? How is that affecting your school, your job? 800-642-1234. I want to look at report cards. DPI released grade cards for the first time since the start of the pandemic last month. The upshot, 87% met or exceeded expectations in the 2020 to 2021 school year. What do you see out of these test scores?
Yeah, so, first and foremost, we strongly urge caution when attempting to compare this year's report cards to previous years. So the ones that came out in November were for the 2020-21 school year. We're in a pandemic, and it affects, you look at how it just weighed heavily on our students and our schools. And when you want, when you want an assessment, you want to make sure that the conditions are the same, and they aren't, right? So, when you look at the calculations, so this was determined prior to my administration, that it was probably a good time to change some of the metrics. And so when they looked at the process of updating the cut scores, they did so earlier this year. They had a technical advisory committee, that looked at the methodology that would preserve the distribution of schools and district ratings in the previous cut scores. Hmm. So in other words, because of the new calculation, overall schools and district scores changed, but they really didn't change that much. The vast majority of school districts didn't change. And so what it did was this updated cut score preserved the intent of the previous cut scores after the new calculations were applied. But I just want to urge caution. When we look at, we're not our best ourselves. You know, when you look at the impact that this pandemic has had, some school districts have weathered the pandemic better than other school districts. And that really, you look at families. Some families have weathered it better than other families and communities. And so all of that is reflected when a kid takes a test, right? And so we need to just urge caution. I think it's going to be uneven for years ahead. Yeah, it really will be.
Superintendent Underley, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.
Jill Underley is State Superintendent of Public Instruction in Wisconsin. Just ahead, the State Capitol Report continues with De Pere Republican State Senator Andre Jacques. What questions do you have about how lawmakers are dealing with the pandemic fallout? Do you have issues with your water? Is your family on bottled water? 800-642-1234 to join in. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Now you're with us for the State Capitol Report, and you have a line to Republican State Senator Andre Jacques of De Pere. We'll discuss clean water legislation, health care, and pre-existing conditions, as well as other topics. Do you live in Appleton, in Kewaunee, Door County, another community that Senator Jacques represents? What questions do you have for him? It's 800-642-1234. State Senator Andre Jacques, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great to be back on the program, Kate.
Good morning. So starting with your personal battle with COVID, and I want to offer my support for your continued recovery and allow you space to talk about what it has been like to battle this disease. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Still working on regaining some strength and physical therapy. But no, I really appreciate the outpouring of support from my constituents and the community. And you know, it's certainly a very serious disease and something that, you know, I think, you know, we've all been kind of rallying together and looking at, you know, just the human effects of this.
With those human effects, did fighting a severe case of COVID, being hospitalized for weeks, did that experience change how you think we should be battling this pandemic or approaching public health?
You know, I guess I didn't really come on the program to talk so much about COVID. I would say there certainly were insights from the time that I went into the hospital in terms of, you know, I wish I had the opportunity to take monoclonal antibodies and some of the other therapeutics that were otherwise available, but not at that point. And but, you know, really it's been... you know, there have been a number of things that I have been working on since the outset of COVID last session that I was able to successfully get through the legislative process. And those continue in this legislative session as well. But, you know, it's been a very busy legislative session. Successful for me.
Right. And just one, I know we're going to talk legislation here. Just one more question, however. If people don't get vaccinated, how do we end this pandemic, especially as you look around Wisconsin?
Well, I think, you know, beyond vaccination, I think we have to look at, you know, this is going to be a long-term issue with mutations that occur with this virus or with any virus. If you look at the flu vaccine or all the variants that we're kind of chasing after right now, I think, you know, really, we have to, focus on what it is that we can do to pull together as opposed to divide ourselves as a community. And certainly when we look at healthcare, there are issues related to, certainly workforce, but also bed capacity. And those have been longstanding concerns. And certainly workforce is a continuing issue within the state when you talk about, more people leaving the workforce than are entering it on a daily basis.
When you say bed capacity, are you talking about hospital bed capacity?
Correct, correct. And there's some legislation that I've been working with somebody in the medical profession who's in the legislature, and that hasn't come forward yet, but I expect it will yet this session.
We're hearing hospital beds are full up with COVID patients, hospitals having to, again, once again, at this stage in the pandemic, deter people away from other hospitals. How do you address this from a lawmaking perspective?
Well, and again, it's not just a workforce issue or a hospital bed issue. It's both. And I mean, I think anybody who doesn't say that is you know, maybe kidding themselves a little bit. I know there is an issue with, and there are times when somebody said, no, it's clearly one and not the other. And certainly there have been issues with other things like, elective surgical procedures or other non-COVID related illnesses that, you know, certainly impact hospital utilization that we're going to have to take a look at when we hit peak periods, I guess.
When you see the governor calling in the National Guard to help fill out the medical staff, what goes through your mind, having been a COVID patient on a ventilator?
Well, I've got the Heroes for Healthcare and military medics and corpsmen, and what we're trying to do right now on a bipartisan basis. I actually spoke about this on Wisconsin Public Television over the weekend, just in terms of the average military medic and corpsman in our military has approximately a year and a half worth of nursing school. And so there are ways that we can get people right now into the healthcare profession doing things that were within their training, within their scope. We're not talking surgery or prescribing drugs or that sort of thing, but something where you have skilled individuals that we can get into our state at a point that we've, you know, previously lost individuals that enter the military service, in part because before Wisconsin was in the minority of states that taxed active duty military pay. That's one of the things I'm very proud of from the most recent budget discussion, which governor did sign, to eliminate the active duty tax on pay. And that's something that now is going to allow us to not lag like we did so many of our active duty servicemen and women as soon as they were deployed or went off to another state for training in one of those other states.
They weren't coming back to Wisconsin. I want to just go back to the military medics here. So this bill would allow veterans with medical training to work in healthcare without a license. So if military medics are able to treat people without a license, and you're saying not do surgery or prescribe medicine, but are able to treat people in the healthcare setting, who then would ensure their skills and abilities without, you know, the examining board there with the licensure?
Well, and we've worked with the examining boards as well as stakeholders, you know, the hospital association, the health cooperatives, primary healthcare association. But basically, they would be working with a licensed professional. There would be a memorandum of understanding. They would have to be fairly recent from their separation from active duty service. And there would also be a requirement that they are, you know, continuing towards a credential.
Do you know how many medics this would apply to?
Well, I think the most conservative estimate from the state was somewhere in the range of about 60 within that first year. A fairly recent program in Virginia that this is modeled after. It's only been in effect for a couple years. They've already had, I believe, over 400 that have taken advantage of it across different tracks. Now, of course, Virginia, there might be a little bit higher in terms of per capita veteran population. Again, that's something that we're trying to build towards here in Wisconsin.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Republican State Senator Andre Jacques of DePere on a range of legislation. You can join in with your concerns at 800-642-1234. Along the lines of health care that you have spearheaded, you sponsored a bill that passed the Assembly that would prevent insurers from denying health care coverage to people based on pre-existing conditions. The Affordable Care Act, the ACA, already bars insurers from doing this. Why do you feel this law is needed?
Well, I think it's a fairly baseline expectation. It's certainly something that I'm very supportive of. I was very pleased that this time it passed with unanimous support out of the state assembly. Of course, last session, that was something that split the Democratic caucus pretty much right down the middle. So I'm glad that we've moved beyond the phase where it was contentious at all. This is something that I think, again, just make sure that we're not going to be discriminating on the basis of a pre-existing condition beyond somebody's control.
You've pushed for this bill before, but part of the reservation on it, I think, was it doesn't go as far as the ACA in providing protections because it didn't regulate self-funded plans from private companies and that it shouldn't include lifetime caps on benefits. What is different about this bill this time around?
I think you might be off on some of those details, Kate. This is very strong legislation, very similar to standalone legislation proposed by Democrats. Now, certainly there were additional things that they tried to throw in there together, like abortion subsidies, things of that nature. This doesn't go to that extent, but we did put the limitations on the caps and the coverage ability basically being the same as the Affordable Care Act. And really, we went to the, I believe it was the Pew Institute that basically said that this was as strong as anything proposed in any legislature in the country. So I think you might be a little...
Okay, well, thank you for the clarification on that. And if people aren't required to have insurance, wouldn't this allow people to simply wait until they're sick to buy insurance?
Well, that is one of the things within Obamacare in terms of the, this is not solving necessarily every issue within healthcare, not that any one piece of legislation can. This is simply addressing that element as something that is going to be the cornerstone of any future within healthcare, because it is one area where I think there has been very broad public and bipartisan agreement.
We're talking with Andre Jacques, Republican state senator from De Pere, chairs the Senate Committee on Human Services, Children and Families. Is your water safe to drink? Are you concerned about your well? What clean water protections do you want lawmakers to act on? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Republican State Senator Andre Jacques of De Pere, who has been first or second author or lead co-sponsor. I counted more than 200 bills and resolutions this year. What legislation do you want lawmakers to take up and move on? What should the state do to protect clean drinking water? What should Wisconsin do to protect people who are vulnerable to abuse and neglect? Still time, 800-642-1234. State Senator Andre Jacques with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's move to water. There are 3 big water problems, as you know, in Wisconsin: PFAS, lead, and nitrates. And along those lines, Jeff called, couldn't stay with us, from Delafield. Jeff asks, how are we protecting our groundwater? And lawmakers, Jeff is asking specifically about regulation related to high-capacity wells and agricultural runoff. What would you tell Jeff?
Well, I think certainly there's a lot that we're doing in terms of trying to address agricultural runoff, trying to address, and I know actually the Wisconsin Farm Bureau just adopted a resolution about looking at the cumulative impacts within well placement. But I happen to chair the Great Lakes St. Lawrence River Legislative Caucus Task Force on nutrient management, and we've been working on quite a few issues related to that. Actually pleased with some of the clean water bills that I've already gotten passed so far this session. That includes the Wisconsin Fund, or the private on-site wastewater treatment system, to assist those of lower income with failing septic systems and repairing those. Certainly we've got Compost. Go ahead.
I was going to say the Wisconsin Fund, as you mentioned, exists to help residents with limited resources who handle the cost of those failing septic systems. And, you know, this is a grant program runs through Department of Safety and Professional Services. Inception was 1978. Governor signed Act 67, reauthorizing the program this year. What do you see it doing?
Well, what we're trying to do is basically eliminate some of the backlog with the program and address more of those failing septic systems that are in need of repair. But we are able to extend the life of the program. It otherwise was going to sunset. And it is something that we've been able to work collaboratively with the administration on. It's been very bipartisan legislation, as have a number of the other environmental bills that I have either proposed or a few of them that have already been signed into law. One of them with the EnviroCheck program is a kind of an outgrowth of my work on the DNR Small Business Environmental Council and trying to increase usage for proactive investigation of environmental issues within the small business community. There's the sand dredging legislation.
I just want to pause right there, as you mentioned the small business community, because in the area of PFAS, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce is opposed to several rules regulating PFAS in water. How will you get the business interests, the small businesses, large and small, on board with future regulation and cleanup of contamination of PFAS?
Well, I don't have legislation that I was looking to talk to about that, but I mean, certainly PFAS is certainly a concern, and certainly there are dedicated funding streams that could be made available when you look at the federal dollars that have been passed on through, what was supposed to be the COVID relief, but certainly that's been a source of lead pipe replacement funding. So I think that that's, you know, certainly something that we'll be taking a look at. That's kind of outside of the nutrient management focus that I've had, but
State Legislative Fiscal Bureau estimates our state is getting $850 million in federal funding to help improve water. So what are your priorities with water on this front?
Well, one of the things that we actually adopted in the budget was the freshwater initiative. And one of the things that I've been working on through GLLC and with some of my colleagues in other states is something called blue accounting and making sure that when we spend large amounts of money, we are focusing on where we're getting that greatest return on investment. So we're also looking at quantifying better. And we've done things before, like the TMDLs, the total maximum daily load studies on all the various watersheds in the area. But in addition to that, just looking at actual dashboards with rating the quality of the water in, our lakes and streams. But there's, the funding level for that, the budget was about $2.5 million. Obviously, there's a lot of additional funding that is available. I mean, how you consider water infrastructure is a bit of a fungible thing, I guess, at this point. But As far as how that money's going to be spent, that's actually going to be one of the workshops we have with the GLLC coming up here in January. So we're going to find out exactly what we can spend it on.
You see bipartisan action on water issues. You see places where you can reach across the aisle and find Democrats who are in lockstep with you, who are on the same page. Where in these instances are these aha moments happening when it comes to water, clean water, and water infrastructure?
Well, I've been able to find very broad bipartisan support for so many of my ideas. I mean, I think I probably have had more Democratic co-sponsors on my legislation than any of my colleagues by a good amount. And certainly part of that is because I've proposed a lot of legislation, but that extends within the environmental area to, we have the innocent purchaser legislation that was just brought forward, where there's actually more Democratic than Republican co-sponsors. But also, again, with the Blue Accounting and Freshwater Initiative, certainly with the environmental bills that have been signed into law, with the Wisconsin Fund and EnviroCheck. Now, one thing that was interesting, the sand dredging bill was modeled after something that did pass on a unanimous bipartisan basis in Indiana, and it was something that both sides were claiming credit for in press releases. Interestingly enough, that actually passed the Wisconsin legislature without Democratic support, at least at the committee level. But Governor Evers did sign that into law, was very pleased. And of course, that's something that we had officials up and down the Lake Michigan shore that were extremely pleased that we were able to do that. Because again, that's very basic common sense reform. And then the manure composting legislation is something that, again, has been very bipartisan. That's a best practice that we can basically have Wisconsin remove one more barrier to being able to create a profit center on the farm for doing the right thing.
Talking with Andre Jacques, Republican State Senator from De Pere, as we discuss legislation he's had a hand in this year. Let's look at vulnerable populations. You have a number of proposals aimed at protecting vulnerable people. One of the things that we're watching for here is the number of long-term care facilities that have been closing or can't accept new residents. And it comes down to money, not being able to offset costs and keep the workforce. What steps can the legislature take to stop this?
Well, certainly there are concerns, I think, within the managed care organizations and what the level of support is for various facilities. I know one of the things that I've worked on, and again, on a bipartisan basis, is really trying to help our independent living centers. We have them across the entire state, all 72 counties. There's eight different organizations, and they really, I think, are not only a return on investment in terms of the cost for being able to keep individuals in their homes or outside of institutions, but you know, it also is something where the social benefits and the greater outcomes that result from that. I've been a big supporter of what we've been able to do with our independent living centers. But yeah, there certainly are a lot of things when you talk about vulnerable populations. I was very pleased with the guardianship legislation that was just signed into law. Again, that was on a unanimous bipartisan basis in both chambers. You know, some of the things we've been able to do with post-traumatic stress and our first responders, as well as others that are in vulnerable occupations. There's been some follow-up legislation that I proposed there as well. And, you know, certainly talking about vulnerable individuals within foster care, basically children in need of protective services.
And
Ethan's Law was another very significant.
And we're going to have to end it there on Ethan's Law. Republican Andre Jacques, State Senator from De Pere, on the State Capitol Report. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.